markers. There we go. And we can actually separate helpers from suppressors, cytotoxic cells, by CD markers. We can use maybe a monoclonal antibody, which is used to find the CD marker, and we make a fluorescent labeled monoclonal antibody. And you know the ones with the fluorescent label go one way and the others go another way, count them all, or any of the number of peripheral blood lymphocytes. Who are the peripheral blood lymphocytes? What's the majority of them? 90% of them fall into one category. What is that?
Macrophages?
No, we were talking about lymphocytes. That gives us a choice of T cell lymphocytes or B cell lymphocytes. You can also put natural tumors in there, suppose you want to do it. Lymphocytes. So, what kind of lymphocytes do we normally find in the peripheral blood? Majority.
T cells.
T cells, right? Because they go into the spleen lymph node, go wandering around. About 10% of them or less are really B cells in transit. And so, would that be normal or not? What do you think?
Normal. Okay, we've got a little bit of a rule there. We'll take that as a rule.
How about interleukin 1 production? What cell produces interleukin 1? It's a monocyte. That helps.
Monocyte.
Very good. An example of a monocyte would be what? The wrong answer from last time, but the right answer is
macrophage.
Ah, there we go. All right. There we go. We were just ahead of time. No problem. All right, so macrophage produce IL-1. And in these complement patients, deficient patients, the macrophage population is how so effective? Is it normal or impaired? And then, no impaired. The hybrid. So what do we got? Is it normal or impaired? Normal, very good. Who said that, Patrick? All right. Very good. All right, so that's normal. Here we go. IL-3 production. Now, IL-3 is going to go what cell? What's that? B cell?
Nope.
T cell. Yes, okay. A helper T cell is that, right? Boy, it's going to be a longer weekend. It's going to be a football game this weekend. You have ever had those, can't you? You lose last week. Shoot, it could have been like Notre Dame, they played and lost. All right, let's see. Interleukin 3 is produced by T helpers, and T helpers are normal or impaired in these complications?
Normal.
PMN chemotaxis. The ability to attract PMN. Is that going to be normal at all times or is that impaired sometimes? Impaired. Macrophage chemotaxis. Now that's going to work out. Is that going to be normal or impaired? Impaired. Okay, so why, what cell produces the chemical factors that we call chemotaxis factors? Involved in chemotaxis of macrophage. What cell produces that? What's that? I think I heard the right answer. T cells, yes. And we already said T cells are normal or impaired? They're normal. So therefore their function is normal and therefore macrophage chemotaxis is normal. Phagocytic digestion, not the ingestion part, that's giving it to the inside cell, but the actual digestion. How's that going to work? The digestion? What cells do the phagocytic digestion? PMNs and macrophages. And those PMNs and macrophages, are they, you know, are they happy? Are they fine? Are they digesting things? To be normal? Yes, okay. Now, the one situation in which the digestion is impaired, a couple of things. We can say that in the case of the diabetic, digestion is impaired. And in the case of a specific enzyme lacking from the process, and that would be myeloperoxidase. So if the lysosome lacks myeloperoxidase, and there are patients that are genetically deficient, in myeloperoxidase, they may have problems in the digestion. But he said also that the diabetic has problems with digestion, but the alcoholic do not, we call it the case. Both the alcoholic and the diabetic have problems with diakinesis, or the extravasculation, moving out of the blood vessel. But once they got to the target, the alcoholic patient's spice speaks up, would digest properly, whereas the patient that had diabetes that would not be good. Okay, acute inflammation. Is that going to be normal or impaired in these complement deficient patients?
Impaired.
Lymphatic and stuff. And what about chronic inflammation?
Normal.
So if you didn't know where I was going on this first problem, but all was sort of ancient Greek or something, you've got some work to do because this is the kind of question that you're going to be asked. In other words, it's not sufficient to know that this cell does that, this system does that, but we want to ask the integrated whole. Because when you're dealing with a patient, it's an integrated whole. Yes, for us to understand it, we have to take apart what we do, but we need to see it in the integrated whole. And these patients, they're not overly concerned about memorizing 500 different kinds of deficiencies. These patients are selected to demonstrate a particular aspect of the overall immune response. It's the knockout mice kind of thing, right? They're experiments of nature. They lack one thing, and we see what the impact of that is. And also then see the value of that one part to the overall healthy immune response. Okay, the George and Rufins. The George and Rufins, these are problems with what kind of cell? It's not macrophage, so no longer are now. It's not macrophage. But we do call on you.
B cells?
B cells would be, which one would be B cell problem?
Bruton's
for B cells. Oh boy, that's. It's Bruton's A gamma globulinemia. A means without, gamma globulin means antibody, emia means in the bloodstream. Without antibody in the bloodstream. Okay. So, the George is a problem with what kind of cell? T cells, okay. So, we have two problems with lymphocytes. Children are born with these problems. They are congenital problems. And so they have a lifelong history of something not working right. We also have to take into consideration that the T cell helper helps the patient make antibodies, right? IL-4, 5, and 6, and all that kind of good stuff. So we need to understand that and appreciate that sort of process. Okay, serum immunoglobulins in a Bruton's patient would be what? Normal or impaired? Impaired. A gamma globulin. Yeah. All right. Now, what about in the DeGeorge syndrome? That's just a T cell problem, so that shouldn't be any problem with antibodies. Is that right or wrong? Wrong. So that's impaired too. So they have about 90% of the epitopes that they can respond to. Excuse me, 10% of the epitopes they can respond to. 90% they can't. But the total immunoglobulin is near normal, but not quite normal. All right, but not quite normal. So they have a problem with epitope range and also the amount of epitope. That's something to look for. Complement components in a DeGeorge patient. They have a problem with T cells, so do they have a problem with complement concentration? No, we not say lateral lamina. Okay. And what about the Bruton's patient? Normal or impaired?
Normal.
Normal. B cells in lymph nodes and T cells in lymph nodes. So we say the George. B cells in lymph nodes, they should look normal. Can you do a test for that? The George patient, will they have B cells? Okay. Well, what about Bruton's patient? Now you're in here. And what about T cells for George in the lymph nodes? Okay. Impaired, and of course, then Bruton's would be normal. Notice the pairing, complementary. Number of peripheral blood lymphocytes. Well, we already know that peripheral blood lymphocytes are what kind of lymphocyte? We know it's not a macrophage, but we know it's a lymphocyte. And so what kind of lymphocyte is it?
T-cell.
T-cell, okay. So George would have the normal number of peripheral blood lymphocytes? Yes or no? No, that would be impaired because that's a T-cell problem. And Rubens, would that be normal or impaired? IL-1 production. IL-1 is produced by macrophage, so therefore the George patient has a problem with macrophage, yes? No, would that be normal? And what about rubens? More normal. Normal. How about IL-3 production, the George? Impaired because there's a T-cell problem. And then rubens would be normal. PMN chemotaxis. No. Get PMN chemotaxis, we have to have what? What initiates chemotaxis? Well, let's go back to that. The chemotactic factor in the tract PMN is coming from where? What is the signal? Complement, the complement components, okay? So we have to activate the complement components. We have to be floating around the bloodstream. So the activated complement components result from what two things coming together? Antigen and antibody. So we have to have an immune complex. Okay? So in order to have PMN chemotaxis functioning normally, we have to have antibody acting with antigen that activates the complement. So in the first two examples of HAE and KA deficient, the complement system was screwed up. So therefore, that chemotaxis was screwed up. In the George and Bruton's, what is not at normal levels?
T cells and
B cells. What product of the T cell and B cell? What's not normal? Antibody is not normal. In both of those cases, the antibody is not normal. T cell helper is lost, so therefore the B cell is not dysfunctional. Okay. So if we don't have the antibody, then we can't have the proper amount of the immune complexes, and therefore we don't have the normal activation of complement, and therefore chemotaxis is impaired in both of those. You see the little subtleties there. You see why you can't sort of memorize this from 1940, because it's a little thing. You have to sort of understand. Memorizing it is sort of faulty. Macrophage chemotaxis. Now that involves what kind of signal system? Macrophage chemotaxis, what kind of signal system? This was Graham Cracker, like Hansel and Gretel. What is the signal system?
T helper cells.
T helper cells releasing a signal. What is the signal? A lymphokine, right? You have migration, inhibitory factor, chemotaxis factor, and permeability reason. Those are all lymphokines. So those are all lymphokines, and therefore, if you don't have T cells, then you don't have helper T cells, then you don't have the product of helper T cells. So what about the George? Chemotaxis normal or impaired?
Impaired.
What about the group of patients? Is the macrophage chemotaxis impaired or not?
No.
No, very good. Is that even? That's good. Is the T cell defined? The B cells don't help the T cells. It's the T cells that help the B cells. So therefore, the problem is only B cells and it's defined just in the B cells. The digestion for both of these would be normal. And the ones in which it would be abnormal would be myeloperoxidase deficient patients, which is an enzyme in the lysosome. The diabetic patient would be impaired digestion. Acute inflammation, normal or impaired? George. It's impaired, correct. Why is it impaired?
Because we need antibodies.
Okay. To get the immune complex, we have to add antigen and antibody. Complement is fine, but the antibody isn't there. Last time I talked about a picnic and someone goes to bring a hot dog. Somebody else goes to bring a brunch. Fine. You don't get hot dogs and butter, but you don't get mustard, you don't get ketchup. All these things are relish. You don't need all these things. And somebody has to bring it. Everybody brings everything, we've got it all. But if somebody doesn't bring something, then we're missing something. Okay, so acute inflammation for the George would be impaired, and of course there's not antibody production movement, so that's impaired. Chronic inflammation. The George? The George chronic inflammation. What cell types involve the chronic inflammation? What cell type? T cells, okay, so they could be normal or impaired. Impaired. And Bruton's problem is B cells, so therefore acute inflammation will be impaired, but chronic inflammation will be what? Normal. Now we have two similar but distinct, the last two are common. Severe combined immunodeficiency has problems with what? Both T and B. Okay. So they're going to be the worst case scenario between the George and Bruton. Either one is compared to compared. AIDS patient is a problem with what? T helper and what other kind of cell is CD4 positive? Macrophage. That may play a role. Okay. Macrophage in the skin patient is normal. It's a lymphocyte problem, a macrophage problem. So that may mean some subtlety difference between the skin and AIDS. We'll take a look at it. Serum immunoglobulin levels. Skin patient? Impaired. AIDS patient? Impaired. There's a lot of problems. Complement components. Skin and AIDS are both normal. On exams, and I don't understand why, but it comes out as a common wrong answer that AIDS patients have a problem with complement. I have no clue where that comes from. So let it not come again. I don't understand where that comes from. The people come up with that particular anomaly. Not true. B cells present in lymph nodes in skin patient. Impaired, okay, they don't have that. B cells in an AIDS patient. Normal. Okay. Lymph nodes. T cells present in lymph nodes in the skin patient. Impaired. And in the AIDS patient. Peripheral lymphocytes, skin patient. Impaired. AIDS patient. Now, when we first started looking at AIDS patients, we didn't know that much about CD markers. We were just playing with CD markers. And so we had a ratio of CD4s and CD8s. That's the helpers and the killers. Cytotoxins and CD8s. And we saw the ratio change. But we didn't know whether the ratio was changing because of one cell was increasing or the other cell was decreasing. That would change the ratio. So if you had more CD8s, then that would change the ratio. If you had less CD4s, that would change the ratio in the same direction. So that's how ignorant we were at the time. But we know a little more right now. Before the CD4 cells are going disappearing, CD8s are not increasing. IL-1 production comes from where again? Macrophage. Okay, so macrophages are normal and impaired in the skin patient. Normal. And in the AIDS patient? Impaired. A little preamble helps. That's going to be on the test. Where else do we find macrophage? Besides in the peripheral blood, where else do we find macrophage? Is there a collection of sites that we have a specific term for that designates macrophages that are not in the bloodstream?
Yes.
What is that called? Three letters.
RES.
Very good. Okay. So the RES, which is the reticular endothelial system, not the RES system, right? But the RES is where we can find it. So that would be another point. So we would find a decline in the number of cells in the RES during infection. This is an infection process. In fact, AIDS is the only infection process we have listed there. So therefore, we would expect to find a decline in the number of helper T cells during the course of infection. We do mark infection that way. CD4 positive cells are marked. It also tells us that pus cells, which are phagocytic cells, which after about 2 to 4 days can include macrophage, could be a likely way of spreading from person to person. It's inside the cell, and the virus goes from person to person. So concomitant illnesses, maybe gonorrhea, which has this strong inflammatory response. A patient with gonorrhea and AIDS is easily spreading AIDS to the next person. And we know that STDs are mixed infections, so try to start putting things together. Interleukin-3 production, that comes from what cell? T helper, all right. In the skin patient, that would be normal or impaired? Mm-hmm. Impaired. In the AIDS patient, of course, that helper is destroyed, right? So that's impaired. PMA chemotaxis on both of these is going to be what?
Normal or impaired? Impaired. It's going to be antibody production. And that's because of the helper T's in the case of AIDS, the helper T's and the B's in the case of SCID.
Macrophage chemotaxis, that's coming from what cell? T helper, and that's going to be impaired hemoglobin as well. Phagocytic digestion is going to be what in both of them?
Normal.
Acute inflammation in both of them is going to be
impaired.
Chronic inflammation in both of them is going to be
impaired.
So, a hint about the problems that might be encountered by patients with these particular kinds of anomalies. And only one of them, remember, was an infectious problem. So if we know the patient's got these certain kinds of problems, if a patient has problems with we know that his humoral immune response is protective against what? What kinds of things are antibody protective against?
Bacterial.
Bacterial agents, most bacteria, right? With the exception of tuberculosis and listeria and things like that. In the cellular, but most bacteria, what else?
Encapsulated
fungal organisms. So we have encapsulated bacteria in there as well as our new bacteria. Anything else? What, how would the response to DPT be? What's B of DPT?
Diphtheria.
What? Toxoid. So what would be the antitoxin response? That would be antibody as well. When you receive the H1N1 immunization, what are you being stimulated to do? Produce what kinds of things? Antibody and T cells, right? C minus one. So that means that a patient that has the George, Rubens, SCIDs, and AIDS is at increased risk of getting intoxications, infections with bacteria, infections with encapsulated bacteria, meaning an increased risk of bacterial pneumonias and meningitis. The complement problem is going to be a problem down here in acute inflammation. Acute inflammation. That's part of our protective response against these bacterial agents. So you can see the risk factors there. So you can sort of look at which one would be increased risk of tuberculosis. Let's take a look. We have to have T cells in which one. Okay, so there's tuberculosis. Tuberculosis. So you can, once you know the diagnosis, you know what kind of things you're at risk for. Or conversely, if a patient, remember that early question in the last exam about the young fellow, the IV drug user, and finally you figure out if the patient had tuberculosis, and then there were questions about AIDS and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is why. It's a logical thought process. There are these little diagrams that we follow on the diagnosis statement. Yes, no kind of thing. And you need to answer the right line of questions, given the right information. So the person who has tuberculosis may, in fact, be an AIDS patient. So these things are all interrelated, the kinds of diseases that they possibly get, and the defects in their immune system. And therefore, the defect demonstrates the part of the immune system that is protected against that particular agent. So it's simpler. Two sides of the same point. You've got a simple idea. So we need to go over that list of things, the laundry list that are in this little field here. Okay. And that should give you a kind of question. Again, that, if I was going to ask an essay question in this material, these would be the essay questions. Do note that the number six question, the number seven would be seven, the last one there. Hypersensitivity types and so on, that's for only on the final. But remember that on the final, you'll have all the questions that you have here and all the questions for the last exam. So the final, you've already begun to prepare for the final because you've already put the last exam. And you'll have begun to prepare for the final when you take this exam. The only thing you haven't seen before is the last part. Half the final will be med micro, like the last exam. Half the final will be immunology based. All the questions will be case studies. All the questions on the final, not the next test, but on the final, all the questions on the final will be single best answer. You go, yay! Until you start taking the test, because then you start saying, oh, wait a second, Ryan, you're getting screwed up here. For number 47, there's really two answers, isn't there?
Uh-uh.
And number 3 is really none, isn't it?
Uh-uh.
So suddenly, you got what you wanted, and it's not what you want. But it does, you are a better taker, test taker of single best answers because you have now been sort of psychologically, mentally prepared to read all the responses because you have to do that with any or none. Prior to this, you'd say, oh, first answer, that's right, we'll move on without reading them all. It's just a common error. And now you realize you have to read them all. Well, final exam, you should read them all as well.
So why is it so?
Because you need to be able to take both kinds of tests.
Right.
And you know, your skills, your test-taking skill on multiples, believe it or not, I know it's frustrating, is actually improved from the first came into the book. And so you're actually improving your test-taking skill. It's a necessary evil. You all have to take the PCAT system, and if you have low PCAT scores, and you have great grades, you didn't get in, or whatever, you know. So there are different performance exams that you have to take. It's not really whether or not you know the material as well. That's one thing. I know this stuff, which also got to produce on certain demands. Okay. Hypersensitivity. Are there any questions about this topic? Alright, so basically, any questions? Hypersensitivity. The word hypersensitivity means an exaggerated immune response. Oh, by the way, I expect to be done with material in time to have a review for the final on Thursday. I expect to be done. That's all part of that 10 minutes that we give you at this lecture. So this is a review. Alright, 5 times of hypersensitivity, but the word hypersensitivity means an exaggerated immune response. So we're going to see antibodies, and we're going to see complement, and we're going to see T cells, and of all the names, all the characters that we've seen before, and now we're seeing them in an unwanted, unprotected manner. Now this took a long time, it was probably about 40 years, for us to develop a classification system. And there are some vestigial terminology that has come about by sort of some of the old ideas clinging to the new structure. But we looked at such things as what kind of cells are involved. Are T cells involved, for example, or not? Is complement involved? What's the timing of the reaction? Is it an immediate reaction or a delayed reaction? All of these were involved in part in previous ways of describing the concepts of hypersensitivity. But now, collectively, they're all bits and pieces of an overview. And the overview results in 5 types of hypersensitivity. The first 4 are shown here. And I'm going to overview all 5 types. And then we'll go into more detail on several of them. Type 1 hypersensitivity, and they do go by the number. You need to know by the number, the real number. I will give you on exam type 1 and so on. You will know what's going on. That's so that you communicate effectively with the rest of the medical community. That's what they're called, type 1 hypersensitivity. But type 1 hypersensitivity, regardless of the antigen, it's the same mechanism. So all of the various types have a common mechanism or two. That's why they're grouped together. They are not grouped together on the basis of what you're allergic to. Now we're talking about an immune response that's not protective. It's up to the individual, a hypersensitivity is an idiosyncratic, that is up to the individual. So it's not precise thinking to say that a certain compound is an allergic compound for many people or all people. That's not the way it works. Penicillin, for example, the beta-lactamarine, less than 10% of the population can be allergic to that. But it's up to their immune system. It's up to their balancing act. Remember that T helper 1 and T helper 2? Well, there's also another one above that, the suppressor and the helper. So if 90% of the people do not respond with, let's say, IgE, which is our type 1 system, IgE antibody to beta-lactamarine, it's not because they can't respond, it's because they are suppressed from responding. So it's not the compound that's allergic, it's the problem on the patient side that makes it so that they're allergic to it. So there's not a particular organic brain structure which stimulates allergic reactions. Anything like that. It's up to the individual's genetics, immunogenetics, that determine whether they're going to respond to something. Now, since it's up to the immunogenetics of something, then we often see that some of these allergic reactions, for example, type 1, correction of IgE, often run in families. You expect that. And so patient histories, you have a mother and father that has hay fever, for example, at the type 1 allergy. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense that you might have it too. So you have a choice of IgM and IgG and IgA and so on, but your system says we're going to produce IgE, which then creates all the problems. So it's not a properly healthy compound, which we sometimes call an allergen, so the antigen can be called an allergen. It's not a property of the allergen, it's a property of the person. So if we're producing a new pharmaceutical, that could be something simple, but children's cough medicine, we're going to put a green yucky color in it, because we find on marketing that they like green yucky colors. Okay? And so we want a green yucky kind of thing. Well, just because we added a new coloring compound, we're going to have to do a lot of testing to find out through testing and clinical trials whether or not that coloring compound demonstrates an allergic reaction in the population. We don't know on the basis of a compound. We have to test it in the basis of the population. Sometimes we don't understand that until we mass produce something and go out. A lot of people have an allergic reaction to that. Who knew? So let's talk about type 1. Type 1 hypersensitivity is IgE-mediated hypersensitivity. As you can see in a little drawing here, IgE is binding by its Fc on the surface of a mast cell. So that means that the mast cell has a receptor site for the Fc of IgE. So that's on the surface. Any receptor site can work. These monomeric structures can bind to cells. IgE can bind to a cell. But it just doesn't bind because it wants to bind. It has to interact with the receptor site on the surface of the cell that's going to bind to it. So there's a receptor site on the surface of a mast cell and a basophil that will allow the Fc of IgE to bind. So now it's sitting out with the surface of the mast cell coated with IgE, with the FABs, looking for the allergen floating there in the surface. The first time you're exposed to the compound, you have no allergic reaction. You don't, because the first time you're exposed, you don't have IgE on the surface of your mast cell to that particular allergen. But within 2 weeks, you will produce vast quantities of IgE. You remember the level of concentration of IgE is very low in the bloodstream. Because as soon as it's made, it's bound on the surface of the mast cell or basophil. And it's not epitope specific on that, so the mast cell or basophil has whatever you're allergic to. Stuff. IgE to ragweed pollen, IgE to dog hair, IgE to poison ivy, whatever it might be. Whatever you might be allergic to on the basis of a type 1 hypersensitivity. But it takes 2 weeks or so for you to get that mast cell coated with the appropriate IgE to that epitope. We call that mast cell or basophil a sensitized cell. meaning it's now ready, primed, and ready to go. The second time you experience the allergen, within minutes, it will bind to the surface, IgE on the surface of the mast cell, trigger a conformational change, which will then activate the mast cell and release a variety of mediators, histamine for now, but we'll talk about many others later, and the histamine comes out and does its thing. And remember, one of the other mediators is really going to be a chemotactic factor for the eosinophils, and the eosinophils will be brought to the liver. And this was part of their protective immune response to what? Something not too common, I'd say it's more common in South America and Africa. Parasitic infection. We still have some. We have a scaries with worm things that crawl around at night and pull on the kids' throats and things. Or pinworms and things like that. We have some, but we don't have dozens like we would in other countries. So we have a model system. Okay? So we have exposure. 2 weeks later, we have another exposure, and now we have a reaction. So if you ask the question, have you ever had an acillin before? That can be an interesting question. Because if you just simply got a one-time shot that may not have lingered in the body long enough, well, it didn't, to actually trigger an allergic reaction for the first time. But if you took 10 days of penicillin orally, aha. Okay. So if you took a single shot of IM administration, intramuscular administration, penicillin. It was not linked to anything that would make me a long-lasting penicillin. We do have drugs to do that. It was just normally, you might not get a reaction. If you did penicillin for 10 days, yeah, that's probably enough to get it going, but even that side effect. But not on the first pill, yes.
So if you're continually exposed to an allergen, then do you start to see a slow reaction over time as the IgE builds up?
No, not necessarily. I mean, if you're continually exposed to something, after about 8 or 10 days, you'll start having a reaction. And the more you're exposed to it, the more you'll trigger memory IgE. You actually have more IgE, including more mast cell, and actually have more mast cell releasing. And it may be the very first allergic reaction, your second exposure, which is the fatal one. Because it's not solely the monosensitized mast cell, it's the effectiveness that the eosinophils have in neutralizing that effect. Also note that the allergen has to cross-link, that is, it involves two molecules of IgE, which is sort of double signal kind of thing. We can see such things as systemic anaphylaxis, that is the anaphylactic shock reaction, which we have massive amounts of histamine released, and other things. And that results in dilation of the blood vessels, the contraction of the muscular tissue, resulting in potential death, beginning in 10 to 20 minutes, and maybe be dead within an hour or two. Or it could be a localized anaphylactic reaction, such as we see in hay fever, runny nose, and runny eyes, and things like that. Asthma, which I'll come back to in a moment, hives, which are localized edema, swelling, food allergy is a little vague. Food allergy on the basis of the type 1 hypersensitivity. The common population term, food allergy, includes a lot of things. It means an adverse reaction to a chemical that was in the coffin. Maybe the young child has hyperactivity kind of episode following, let's say, the great cough medicine, the great flavor. That's not an immune-based reaction. That's not an immune response. That's not an allergy. It may be a chemical sensitization of some sort, or it may be a pigment of the mother's body's imagination, I don't know. But it's not an immune-based reaction. So hyperactivity of children on the basis of food coloring is not allergic reaction. Now asthma, asthma is itchiness. Asthma is sort of unusual in one respect. For an asthmatic patient, we may or may not see an IgE to a particular allergen. What we do see is a release of mediators. So that means we can have exercise-induced asthma. Or we can have, you were in a car accident and suddenly something had a panic attack because of all the excitement in the car accident. Well, they're having a true physiological problem, not imaginary, and it's based on the release of mediators from mast cells. So the treatment is going to be neutralizing those mediators, antihistamines, adrenaline, and so on. But we have not identified, in most cases, a particular allergen that's doing it. So we're not really certain what's triggering the release. Is there some sort of genetic deficiency in the control mechanism of the release of the mast cells in the patients? We're not sure. So it's characterized here as a type 1 hypersensitivity. And there are certainly patients that have asthma, which we have identified an allergen for. And it truly fits into a type 1 completely. But there are patients that have asthma in the past that we can't link to a particular allergen. So it's a little fuzzy. So that's type 1. IgE, mast cell, eosinophils, possibly a systemic reaction, an anaphylactic shock nature, can kill you. Type 2 is usually, with one exception, an IgG antibody. Remember, this is IgG. Now, type 2, you have this sheet right there. Type 2 involves an antibody that is bound to its target cell by its FAB, not the FC sitting there dangling its FAB. It's actually binding to the cell by its FAB. So that means the target cell has an epitope on it that you are responding to. And this would be very similar to the way we would destroy, you know, bacteria or something. But in this case, it's not a bacteria that's a target cell. It's one of your cells that's a target cell. So you are producing an immune response to your own tissue. Clearly, we're going to be talking about allergic reactions that are autoimmune diseases in this category. But that's not the only one. One example in which it is an IgM, and only one example, is transfusion. If we give the patient the wrong unit of blood, they are group B, and we give them group A blood, they will have a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Let's back up a little bit so we understand. You should have had this in physiology, but we'll review it for you. If you're a group A individual, you will be controlled, hopefully, so that you do not produce an antibody to A substance. The blood group substances of A and B are ubiquitous. They are found on surfaces of bacteria, they are found in foods, they are found in nature. You will be exposed to them. So very early on in life, you will produce an antibody to what you aren't. So if you're group A, you'll produce antibody to B. Now the interesting thing about this is that we have evolved as a humankind to not have an IgG to that blood group. We only have IgM to that blood group. And there's an obvious, if you think about it, an obvious survival advantage. You'll recall that IgM does not cross the placenta. The IgG does. So if we had the capacity to produce an IgG to the ABO system, that means that the mother and the fetus would be in conflict if the fetus was not the same blood group as the mother. Okay? And therefore, there'd be a lot of infant fatalities. So we've evolved to have probably some sort of genetic mutant that doesn't produce the IgG, and that suddenly becomes the dominant variety because they get overpopulated because the other ones die off so quickly. So for that particular antigen, we do not produce a memory response. We don't There's also the Lutheran that got me the kid, the MNU, and there's lots of them. Okay, you don't need to memorize them. But there's lots and lots of different blood groups. And for all of them, you will produce an IgM and an IgG. All of them but the ABO. Erythroblastosis fetalis there is an Rh incompatibility. Rh stands for rhesus monkeys, and Rh is found in the surface of about 85% of Caucasian Americans. So it's a racial kind of thing. And so we do have a concern that we can have an Rh incompatibility. So if we do produce the IgG to this is exposed. So if we have, as you know, an Rh negative mother exposed to an Rh positive fetus during pregnancy, or certainly at the time of delivery, the mother will be exposed to the Rh substance. The mother then will produce an IgM and then an IgG to the Rh factor. So therefore, subsequent Rh positive fetuses in the Rh negative mother can be attacked by the IgG against the Rh factor that the mother has. With each subsequent pregnancy, we have a higher and higher concentration of antibody, more antibody crosses the placenta, and a greater fatality rate of the child. That's the erythroblastosis fetalis phenomenon. What we do for that particular patient is, if we have an Rh positive, Rh negative mother, and an Rh positive pregnancy, or a pregnancy in which we do not know whether the fetus is already positive or negative, for example, a miscarriage or abortion of some sort, then we have a duty to expose the mother to antibodies to the Rh factor. That's called ROGAM, capital R-H, capital R, little H-O, capital G-A-M, ROGAM, which is an example of artificial passive immunization. We give the mother already made antibodies to the Rh factor. The mother then has immune clearance and complement cleans it all up, complement and antibody antigen come together, complement activation, reophagocytosis. We get rid of those fetal cells before the mother's immune system can actually say, wait, I should do something about that. And so therefore, it's an example of a type of immunosuppression, although we really don't call it that, because it's really avoidance of the allergen. But the end result is sort of like immunosuppression. But basically, the mother does not produce the antibody to the Rh. We used to give it when we first developed ROGAM, in the 60s, we would give it after delivery, within 48 hours of delivery and so on. But now we actually give it during the pregnancy itself, just in case of some leakage of cells. So the idea of having erythroblastosis fetalis, that is, a blue baby, the baby is being attacked because it's dying because it doesn't have sufficient red blood cells in the utero, and we have to give transfusions and all that stuff, that's a thing of the past in large part. We don't see that. The only time we have that is if we had an unmonitored pregnancy, which could occur with people who not having health insurance, and then complement result in the lysis of the target cell. So we have complement activation. There is one other possibility. ABCC. Sounds like a government program of some sort. But ABCC stands for antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity. ABCC, antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity. And you can see the drawing at the top. We have an antibody bound to the surface of the cell. And we have a cell that has an Fc receptor for bound IgG. And this is there's a cytotoxic cell. See that? That's a null T cell. These null T cells, they don't have all the surface markers on them, the natural killer cell. Sort of a forerunner of having a full-blown T cell system. Well, when I talk to the nursing students, I give them a little analogy. I give them more analogies about things you can kind of more subtle and pick up things easier, but some of them have to make great leaps. So I use this analogy. Maybe it'll help on Thursday with snow. You can think of the Vietnam T cells as blind samurai warriors. Okay? And they are 7 feet tall, big guys. And they've got a 7-foot sword. The sword is the fact that they have lymphocytotoxin. They can kill, but they're blind, and they can't see you. So they're wandering around looking for them, but they can't see you. But they have a pet bird called antibody. And antibody sits on your head and starts squawking, and they measure about 8 inches low, and the squawking sound off your head. Okay? So the null T cell is blind. It cannot see the target. But it does have a receptor site for bound IgG. So that null T cell up there can then find a cell that's coated with IgE, release its lymphocytotoxin, and kill that coated cell. Antibody-dependent, cell-mediated cytotoxicity. A normal T cell wouldn't need antibody. But a null cell, blind, can't see its target. So basically, the problem with the null cell is that it's not epitope-specific. Okay. It requires the antibody to be the epitope-specific signal, and then it recognizes the FC of bound IgG regardless of what the epitope was. So the specificity of the reaction comes about with the antibody on the cell. Now, as with most things that are complement, most things that are hypersensitivity, there is a good side to that. The good side of that is part of our overall armament against tumor cells. So part of our anti-cancer function, part of the way in which we respond to T cells, respond to tumor cells, is to produce an ABCC reaction that's protective. You may recall I mentioned Reut in the UK and his use of the anti-immunotype vaccine. He wanted to stimulate antibodies to a patient, but he didn't want to inject the patient with a tumor. Remember that weird thing, he used an antibody as an antigen? Well, that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to boost up ABCC as an anti-tumor response in these patients. So antibody is involved in the destruction of tumor, and it's this null T cell. Now, there are not a whole bunch of null T cells. The vast majority of your anti-tumor response is not this, but it is part of it. And you can see that it's sort of a hybrid, it's sort of an intermediate step in a sort of an evolutionary kind of mode before we get the full-blown T cells that can have their own receptors for epitope and so on. So ABCC. And we'll see that we can see ABCC reaction, for example, in diabetes and so on. We'll show you that in the book. Okay. So again, we have an antibody directed against the surface component, and we have destruction via complement activation or to null T cells. Type 3, immune complex mediated reaction. Immune complex mediated reaction. Immune complex is antigen antibody coming together. It's going to be activated complement. So we're going to have antigen antibody activating complement. There's two classic phenomena. One is called the Arthus reaction, and the other one is historically called serum sickness. But more commonly, immune complex disease, ICD. So there are really two types of type 3. In both cases, we have antigen antibody activating complement, resulting in an acute inflammatory response to the place of the body. And you can see it's a massive infiltration of neutrophils, and there's neutrophils of PMN. So we have this unwanted inflammatory response. Let's take a look at the Arthus reaction first. We have both antigen and antibody. And in Arthus reaction, we have an excess of antibody. As we'll see in the immune complex disease, we have excess of antigen. So that's how we're going to break the two kinds out. So we have an excess of antibody. So a patient has lots and lots of antibody in them, and they have a reaction. Arthus was, in the turn of the century, in the 1900s, experimenting with various kinds of antiseries, and he was enamored by the fact that you could have an antibody to, you know, orthometapair positions on benzene rings, and they were so epitope-specific, they were much more specific than enzyme substrate. He was into that kind of thing. So he wanted lots and lots of antibody. and he was getting it from bunny rabbits. So he was injecting the rabbits into the ear vein with various kinds of things. Nothing nasty, maybe bovine serum albumin was a common one. So we get bovine serum albumin, we have lots of cows, we have lots and lots of serum in them. Albumin is the largest protein in the serum in concentration, so you get this easily in large amounts. So he had a nice, convenient, cheap antigen, and he's injecting it into the rabbit ears. And he wanted more and more antibodies, so he kept injecting every couple of weeks. He'd inject, always into the ear vein, because it was the easiest thing to get his needle into. And everything was going well, and that was the standard procedure. And then he noticed, because I guess he got a little greedy, he wanted lots of antibody, highest concentration, highest titer of antibody. He noticed that some of them, they were getting like little red spots where he was injecting. Didn't bother, he kept injecting. And then it turned necrotic. And the whole ear turned black and fell off. That's not good. So why did that happen? I mean, all I did was inject the bovine serum of human, and I did it 10 times before. Why is now, is it having a problem? Okay. So what's happening is inside the rabbit, there were high concentrations of antibodies. Artificially, I think he injected it so many times. Now he is injecting it into the blood vessel. So this is the surface of the blood vessel. He's injecting the antigen there. High levels of antibody creates an immune complex right at the point of the injection. So now he has activation of complement. As you imagine, it's coming out of the needle. It's creating an immune complex as an activation, just as he's injecting it right out of the needle. So therefore, this reaction is right there. So it's a local vasculitis. So what is creating? The redness. And then necrosis was a local vasculitis. The redness was the inflammatory response to the swelling and pain. Eventually, that resulted in the release of enough compounds from the complement system that we were destroying the blood vessels, loss of blood supply, and we have necrosis, and then we have that position here. Well, that was an interesting thing he wrote about, studied about, and so on. It was not what he was originally looking for, but got a name in the literature. We did not see this, however, as a clinical entity until the 1960s. In the 1960s, there was a culture in the United States and everywhere, Europe and Asia as well, a culture of experimentation with drugs. And people would inject themselves with almost anything, looking for the endless high. I mean, literally, almost anything. Southern companies would inject themselves with Southern companies. People would inject themselves with banana oil. Let's see what banana oil does. Peppermint, just try peppermint. Maybe that does it. Oregano leaves, let's grind it up. And olive oil, we'll inject ourselves with anything to see what it does. In that setting, we started to see some unusual reactions. I know one fellow that injected himself with a peanut butter. He was a young fellow, he was about 14 or so, put tourniquets on all of his arms and legs, and he lived. You can imagine what that's doing to him. You're talking about cholesterol, imagine, just pumping in lymph under your blood vessels, clots, hemorrhaging, oh, it was a mess. But he lived. Anyway, so we have these people that are injecting themselves, and starting to see Arthur's reaction. I'll give you one case study. And you will not forget this case study. I guarantee you will remember this case study on your 10th anniversary, or maybe even beyond. I'll be in Ireland and having a good time, and we'll be having an anniversary. A reunion. It's happening in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A fellow was using cocaine, and he was injecting himself with cocaine, and he found that one of the side effects of cocaine was an erection that would last for hours. He thought that was a good idea, because now the television commercial says you have to go to the emergency room with that kind of thing. True. That's okay. But anyway, he was injecting, and so he thought, where should he inject himself to do the most good? And he didn't know about arcus and ears and rabbits and things like that. So he injected himself. He got a little redness in the vein there after a while, but yeah, it was worth it, you say. And then it turned necrotic and fell off. So now when he does number one and number two, he does it both from the seated position. Yeah. So his penis got frozen. So you won't forget that part. So that is why, for example, when we inject patients, we don't repeatedly inject them into the blood vessels with anything. Okay. So a diabetic is intramuscular. We always do IM. That's safer. You do IV into somebody with something, and you do it repeatedly, you're allowed to have an arthritis reaction, particularly if you do it at the same site. Now, drug abusers, you know, if they're going to do an IV drug, they don't need all of this, very detail. But sometimes they have trouble getting it into the veins. Okay? So they have certain veins that they prefer. And sometimes they'll put a tattoo onto that vein so they can find it. It might be the eye of a snake or something like that. And then you can get it right into the right, not in their hands or their hands and their feet. Okay? And of course, they're going to get a lot of staph infections. And if they carbonize the needle, or sterilize the needle with a mesh or something like that, and get carbon in, they get, you know, some needle traps and carbon. But most of the needle traps, we call needle traps, are really staph infections from the infection, from these types of infections. But if they're going in the same spot, and if the drug is diluted with the same thing, they call it cutting the drug. And so sometimes they can do it with, you know, if it's a white powder, they can use sugar, the white powder. Sometimes it's a white powder, you use battery acid because it works the same. You know, battery corrosion acid, yeah, and then I'd rather the battery just scrape it out and put that in. I mean, they're not pharmaceutical agents. Like, they're just trying to make it pop. And so if the person does it, dies, and that's their problem. And so if they use the same thing to cut it, and they're having an allergic reaction to that, that's what can give a problem. It's not always an allergic reaction to the drug itself, but what the drug is diluted with. So there's an arthritis reaction you won't forget. Now, the other kind of problem is, an arthritis reaction is a necrotizing vasculitis. So the arthritis reaction is a necrotizing vasculitis. Now, serum sickness is just the opposite in terms of the antigen-antibody problem. In serum sickness, we have excess antigen. So we're approaching that immune complex from a different point of view. Initially, it was called serum sickness. And this was in Germany, 1920s and 30s. We were using horse serum as an oxidizing antibody. The patient had pneumonia and meningitis. Now, we know that an antibody that binds to the capsule enhances phagocytosis. We call that oxidization. You can use passive immunization by giving somebody else's antibodies to you. And that's what they were doing. They were using horse serum. Okay. We try to avoid non-human sources of antibody. There's still a few out there, but we try to have human sources whenever possible to avoid this particular reaction. So if you were sick with pneumonia once and you got the horse serum and you got better, that'd be fine. But if you got sick repeatedly and we gave you horse serum for various things, you started having a reaction to the horse serum, of which they gave you 500 milliliters of. So you had a unit or more of horse serum, which you have an immune response to. So you have lots of antibody, and you produce antibody, lots of antigen, and you produce antibody to it. So it's an antigen excess problem. Well, we couldn't have that problem much anymore, unless you get a messenger to stop the messenger. We shouldn't have a problem like that much anymore, because we don't use foreign serum. We try to avoid using foreign serum. However, we realized that was really an indication of a broader kind of problem that we now call immune complex. And any situation where we have lots of antigen that can trigger these systemic effects, for example, it could be a patient with hepatitis B. And if they're chronic active hepatitis B and they're producing antigen for 10 years, they've got lots of antigen. Okay. And that antigen, of course, is the virus. And so they're antigen excess. It could be an autoimmune disease. Rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus. Those are all autoimmune diseases. So in the serum sickness, we have a whole body phenomenon, not a localized problem. This whole body problem is associated with lots and lots of antigen throughout the body. These immune complexes, when they occur, are being trapped at specific locations. So they always have the same sites for possible inflammatory response. It's not the site of injection that we saw in markers, but rather these are the following. Joints. So you have a joint pain. knee, an elbow, a knuckle, joint pain. So we have the immune complex trapped in the joint, activating complement, causing redness, swelling, heat, and pain in the joint. You immediately imagine that being in the vertebrae. By the way, the antigen there is an altered IgG. We're producing IgM or IgG. It's anti-idiocyte antigen. More about that later. But that's in the rheumatoid arthritis. But they're getting trapped in the joint. You also have them trapped in the kidney. So we have kidney inflammation. We have glomerular nephritis. I'll talk about a post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, where we had immune complex trapped. That was a transient event. If we have a patient that has this weight gain that we talked about, you know, blood pressure is rising, and their kidneys aren't working right, and we do the anti-streptolysin O, the ASO titer, and it's flat, and we do it 3 days later and nothing's happening, then we know it's not post-streptococcal disease, but it is a form of glomerulonephritis, and it is probably an immune-based glomerulonephritis, and we'll talk about some of the problems. This is going to be an ICD problem. We also have heart, the circulatory system in the heart is sort of close between the veins and the arteries. And what happens in the capillary bed is we have trapping of the immune complex. So we have cardiac inflammation. We also have inflammation at the choroidal plexus, which is where we have the fluid going from the bloodstream into the spinal fluid. And it's like a filter trap there, choroidal plexus. And we can also see this in the conjunctiva of the eye. We can look at someone's eyes, and they're going to be red. Okay, we have complement activation, dilation of the blood vessels in their eyes. Okay. So these are going to be common, but regardless of what the antigen is, if you're having a type 3 immune complex disease-related mechanism, joint pain, kidney pain, heart problems, eye problems, blood pressure problems, pressure in the spinal fluid, which is a very common headaches and stiff necks and so on, because the blood pressure is not, the cerebral spinal fluid pressure is not right because of the clog there, the choroidal plexus. So you see a lot of issues going on. My goodness, what one thing could cause all these problems? Now remember, a given patient is not going to have all of these problems, but they're going to have this cluster that doesn't make sense. There must be a variety of just weird things that happen to this person. You know, they got a head injury, and a few days later they got a knee problem, and now they've got cardiac irregularities, and they've got blood pressure rising, and these are all just unrelated events. No, they're not unrelated. It's this system that's going on, and it's an immune complex disease. But we'll give some examples of that. Now we're looking at digital cinema reality. What's that? Oh, it's no longer part of it. Does someone think about this? You know, what happens sometimes, you know, those things, they broadcast frequency that can go from room to room to room to room. It could easily be able to say it. And it's only on this one, though. This is not that one. How's that? So I can, it's not on my screen, so I can't do anything about it. Okay. At any rate, so that's type 3. So there are two types. There were two types of type 2. Right? There are two types of type 2, ABCC and complement activation. Two types of type 3, ARTHIS and CIRRHOSIS. Type 4 hypersensitivity. Type 4 hypersensitivity is a T cell only problem. And we have a specialized cell population. T cells involved and delayed type hypersensitivity. So the vestigial language of immediate type hypersensitivity, which is type 1, because it begins in minutes, immediate, and delayed type is type 4. Okay. So we have delayed type hypersensitivity. So it's TDTH, which is T cell or delayed type hypersensitivity. So it's a subpopulation of T cells. And they release a variety of cytokines, leukokines, which we've seen before. So they release the normal kinds of things. And we can also see some cytotoxic T cells involved. We have two subpopulations of T cells. We have no antibody involved in this at all. We can see this commonly with contact dermatitis. That's probably the most common kind of problem we'll see along the line. Contact dermatitis. That means you come in contact with the allergen, and now you're having a redness, an itchiness, because it's going to be T cells activating. It's like a chronic inflammatory response. We're going to have a release of histamine.
Okay.
So we might have poison ivy. So for poison ivy, we might use hydrocortisone, 0.5%, something like that. But we'll suppress the T cells in that area on the skin. And we might also use something like calamite lotion or something, which is an antihistamine, topical antihistamine. So the mediator is coming through the mast cells. We need to neutralize the histamine. It's not getting rid of everything, but it's going to neutralize the histamine. But it's a local reaction.
Okay.
It's contact, wherever that contact was. And we're going to have T cells that are all excited, so we're going to put them back to sleep with hydrocortisone, topical hydrocortisone, at that location. Remember always that we have contact dermatitis and we have to get rid of the allergen. The treatment alone without getting rid of the allergen is not the solution.
Okay.
So if the person is allergic to something and they continue to be exposed to it, you can't help yourself. So you have to find out what the person is allergic to. A little detective work has to be done.
When did this occur and how did it occur?
With poison ivy. Poison oak would be examples of contact dermatitis. Nickel-containing compounds, maybe like a tattoo, could be a problem. Contact dermatitis. So we have to remove the tattoo. It could be neomycin, which is used as a topical antibiotic. That could be a problem. It could be detergent. People have detergent allergies. Can't do the dishes, mom and dad, because I got detergent allergy. Anybody give you a glove?
Wow, no.
I'm allergic to latex, too. People could be allergic to latex, they have condom problems and things like that. But it's direct contact. Contact with the type. Now, there's also the same kind of reaction is seen in the latter stages of tuberculosis. Remember, the first stage of tuberculosis, you have this granuloma forming, and then T cells walling off and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, it goes south, and at some point, we use so many cytokines that we cause the lungs to go into caseation, which is a formation of the TZ lung, which is basically a non-functional area, and it can spread through the body, and then this could be death. So basically, the latter phase of that is an allergic reaction to type 4 hypersensitivity, not protected. Graft rejection. When we talk about tissue typing and so on, we talk about all the good things that happen. There's two types of rejections that can occur. The first type of rejection is a type 2 hypersensitivity, in which the patient gets a new kidney, and they've already rejected the kidney before, and now the new kidney has the same antigens on its surface, and you have the antibodies already to it, so you start rejecting it immediately. In fact, what the surgeons call a white graft, meaning as soon as they hooked up the blood vessels to the kidney, the reaction is occurring in the kidney. You begin destroying it before you even zip up the patient. That's an immediate type of reaction because you already have the antibodies. It's not immediate hypersensitivity, it's a type 2 reaction. It's not IgE, but it's an IgG complement kind of problem. But you already have seen that antigen before, and now you're reacting to it again. So we can avoid that because we test the patient's sera to find out what antibodies we can expect to see when we try to transplant that. So we can avoid that one. The second type is the type 4 reaction. This is the T cell. This is the classic graft rejection you see in heart transplants. And that's a type 4 hypersensitivity. So that's why we immunosuppress them with T cell suppressors. So all the way to the end, you get there faster than I did. Okay. I want to be on here. I'm going to go to the end. And we'll talk about type 5. Thank you. undefined hypersensitivity. It's also known as Graves' disease. There should be an apostrophe here. Patrick Graves. Patrick Graves, an Irish physician, first observed this. It's a hyperthyroidism, and the person develops an IgG to the thyroid stimulating hormone receptor site. TSH, it goes back to the anesthesiology of that thing. On the left hand side of the mic, you've got thyroid cell has a TSH receptor site. Isn't it interesting that we have something binding to a receptor site, that once something binds to it, there's a conformational change that goes through the membrane and begins an activation which involves phosphorylation reaction that triggers then the DNA to do something. Isn't that interesting? Could that be related to it? Yeah, sure. Okay. Super immunoglobulin family stuff, right? At any rate, we have the normal process of thyroid-stimulating hormone binding to the TSH receptor site, activating the thyroid to produce thyroxin, and you get all that sort of stuff. Right? And there's a negative feedback, thyroxin feedback pituitary that says, enough of this stuff, we don't need to do it. In the case of Graves' disease, we have an autoantibody, an IgG antibody, that binds to the thyroid-stimulating hormone receptor site. Now it does bind to two of them, so we have that cross-linking that the antibody does. It does the same thing. It activates it to do it. The difference is the thyroxin feeds back to the pituitary, and the pituitary says, I didn't do it. I'm not producing TSH. Not me. Oh, sure, you must. No, I'm not. So we have the dialogue back and forth. So basically what's happening is we have an antibody that's uncontrolled that's resulting in a stimulation. So we have a hyperactivity. We have a hyperthyroidism. Okay? That's Graves' disease. The symptoms will be, symptoms are going to be such things as accelerated heart rate, which can do damage to the heart if left unchecked. We'll have a dryness of the skin. We'll have weight loss because you've got the metabolism just cracked up too high. Your heart rate, your resting heart rate is 140 beats a minute or something. And then we also have this exophthalmic reaction, the eyes sort of bugging out. When the eye bugs out, you see the whites of the eye all the way around the pupil, all the way around the iris. You remember you saw this maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember exactly when. There was this woman from Atlanta, Georgia that said she was kidnapped because she didn't want to get married. Remember that one? And you saw her in the airport and they took her away from Denver. She said she was kidnapped by some people. It wasn't that way at all. She was just a little flaky, right? Well, if you looked her in the eyes, she looked really funny. You can see the whites of her eyes all the way around. Now, if you look at each other's eye, you see that you don't have the white above your eye. So you don't have this clear white color. You see the white, that's the eye bulging out. So the surface of the eye is coming out. It's an exophthalmic reaction. She might have had Graves' disease, or at least that might be one of her problems. So if you go to the mall, you can see this all the time. You see the eye. There's no eye. But this is an exophthalmic reaction associated with Graves' disease. Fairly common problem, and it's not a big problem as long as you handle it early enough. If you don't handle it enough, it could cause cardiac problems and arrhythmias, and it could be more problems. But if you handle it easily enough, it's the best way to go. Now, there's a couple ways of doing it. If you like a clean, quick solution, you just simply cut off the thyroid. You get this little necklace kind of surgical incision, and you just take the thyroid out. And you no longer have a target, you no longer produce thyroxin, but thyroxin is so cheap that they give it away. So, Kmart and Walmart and Myers and so on, if you work, that's one of the ones they often just give away. They actually make you pay for it, I don't know, it's like $8 a month or something. It's not a very expensive thing. And so the thyroxin, which is a change in the collagen and so on. But anyway, the compound, you just simply take a pill a day and you're fine. Well, that's a solution. Another solution would be to, instead of surgically remove it, we can use radioactive iodine-131. And iodine-131, given at low dose for the body, will concentrate at high dose in the thyroid and burn it out. So we basically destroy your thyroid that way. Third alternative, which is not my favorite, but a third alternative is to use pharmaceutical drugs to gradually cut back the thyroid. And the gradual part of the part I'm not a big fan of. So it could take months or years to get down to a point where you've got just a little bit of thyroid left. And you're still producing the iodine antibody all the time. But it's now giving you almost a near normal level of thyroxine production. But that's a tough pinpoint to hit. And you do force that person to go through hyperthyroidism for many, many months before you start bringing it down. So I'm more of a favor of just cutting it out over iodine-131. But there are these alternatives. But notice what we're not doing to the patient is immunosuppressing them. When we're done, in all events, you'll still be producing the antibody. Because it's immunosuppression, it's not so specific, and therefore we have all these other problems. And if the thyroid is primarily producing thyroxine, we can replace it at an inexpensive cost. That's the way that's brain disease. Okay? A hyperthyroidism. So that's the five types of hypersensitivity. And we're going to go back to it. So now you have an overview of all five types. You can go into more detail of some of them and less than some of them. For example, brain disease type 5 is the only type 5. It's the only example of a stimulatory hypersensitivity. And so we've done that. But as you might expect, on exam questions, you will find some kinds of autoimmune diseases that destroy the thyroid, result in hypothyroidism. And so there'll be some questions we'll talk about. Hypothyroidism is compared to hyperthyroidism. Hypothyroidism. We'll come back to that. Type 1 hypersensitivity. We know IgE, mast cells, mediated release. You know this already. What can be allergic to? All kinds of things. What are common things? I'm not going to give you what's common in the United States. It's just common differently in different parts of the world. Foreign serum, that is a non-human-based serum, could be a problem. From vaccines, you could be allergic to eggs and the raise of the virus in an egg, then that could be a problem. So that's why when we ask you to make sure it's vaccine, grade 1N1, are you allergic to eggs? We'll avoid a type 1 reaction in the patient. Plant pollen, we've got all kinds of. Remember, these are genetic, and if you're allergic to one, you're often allergic to a whole bunch. Trees, ivy, pollen, bee fever. Drug allergies, we're going to see a drug allergy in all first four varieties. There's a drug allergy of a type 1 mechanism, a type 2 mechanism, a type 3, and a type 4 mechanism. So drug allergies can be of many different kinds of mechanisms. So there are drug allergies, again, type 1 variety, penicillin, sulfonamides, anesthetics, salicylates, foods, wide variety of food allergies. Nuts are a common one. Seafood is common. Remember, with seafood, it could be an allergic reaction that is associated with iodine and iodine binding proteins. And iodine binding protein is the kind of dye that we use for certain imaging. And so we could inject the person with an iodine compound to image their kidney, for example, and they would have a type 1 reaction right there in the site where we gave the injection, or in the room where we gave the injection. We want to avoid that. So we ask patients, you're going to get this radio imaging, and we're asking you about seafood allergies. What's all that about? Eggs, you have, as we mentioned, eggs, vaccines, peas and beans, milk proteins. Insect products, venoms and things like that. You can be allergic to dust mites, okay? Mold spores, animal hair, dander. Dander is flaky skin. So you could be allergic to dust, let's say. And so what we do is we take the contents of your vacuum cleaner and make a saline extract and inject it in your skin to see if it's in there or not. And then we can start figuring out what it might be. All kinds of things. sometimes they're allergic to the dust mites, and they're mites and different kinds of mites. Dust mites are one category. Some of these mites, they live in your bed and they live off of your skin, and they defecate. And people are allergic to the defecation of these little critters. And so it could be a weird thing. You go to Aunt Susie's cabin, and there's something in the cabin that triggers you to have a reaction. It could be a mold or something. We see problems in Michigan with sort of a wintertime allergy. Someone gets a runny nose, a common cold kind of thing, rhinovirus, coronavirus, adenovirus kind of thing. And in their sick room, they put in a humidifier they got at the Deer Dust Room. And it's just a little box with water, and you just throw the water up at the end of the fan. And they bought it 1 year, and they put it in the garage or the basement or the attic or whatever, and they bring it out, they put more water in it, and they do it again. The problem, however, is there's spores from the previous year in there. They did not clean it out with Clorox. There's a little filter in there. They did not clean that up. So what happens is that they add water, activate the fungal organisms, and now the little kids in there, 3 or 4 years old, in the sick room, they put the humidifier on, and they increase all these mold spores right in the bedroom. Okay. And what began as a common cold continues on with runny nose and teary eyes and so on, as they move into a type 1 allergy to the mold growing up in the bedroom. And they wonder what's happening. This kid had this runny nose for 2 months. What's wrong? So if someone's using these humidifiers, they have to clean them out with Clorox and soap and water and get rid of the problem. Also, the mold can be in the wood that you bring in the house to heat your house, if you're bringing in wood, the bark and all that kind of stuff. It's certainly got mold on it. And same would be true of plants and the soil in your house. And so you might have to get rubber trees or plastic and things like that. But you need to avoid those kind of things. Household dust contains a variety of things. It could be fabric that you could be allergic to. Okay. Lots of things in household dust. So the key thing when you have a type 1 allergy, find what you're allergic to and avoid it. That's the number one thing. You've got to find what you're allergic to and don't do that. I know a guy that's allergic to bee stings and he makes honey. What's wrong with this thing? So you have all these kinds of stuff to deal with. Well, people are allergic to horses and dogs and rabbits, and they raise horses and dogs. And they're allergic to the animal hair and then. Well, these are the mast cells, where our problems are beginning from. And notice these little vacuoles around the periphery. They're the ones that contain all these different mediators, such as histamine and so on. And a brief review of what you already know. We got the helper cell, and it's releasing more than IL-4, 4, 5, and 6, and you know, all that sort of stuff already. And we have a plasma cell, and it produces the IgE. Now, the cartoonist that made this did a good job about some things, and not too good job about other things. They did attempt to show the binding of IgE up to different epitopes on the surface of the mast cell. See, they're binding to the Fc receptor for IgE, so we have your binding IgE, and that would be good. And they're trying to show that this one might be derived because this one would be penicillin, beta-lactamarine, and so on. So they're showing these different colors indicating different episodes. And then they got screwed up here, and they got one that's sort of sideways, about like that they need, and that would be the case. So this was a screw-up in the cartoon, but they intended to do it. So now we have a sensitized mast cell, meaning it's got IgE on the surface. You're exposed to the allergen, whatever it might be, and again, they screw up again. They have two IgE binding to the same allergen. Now, this could be true if the allergen had multiple epitopes on its surface, but it's a little misleading to the first observer. So if you assume the allergen is pure epitope, possibly, which is based on they would both be the same color. But nonetheless, we have IgE binding. We have the wiggle that occurs, operational change. The signal goes on the inside, and the release of a variety of things. These mediators affect smooth muscle, small blood vessels, mucus secretions increase, platelets get sticky, nerve endings are activated, and eosinophils are drawn to the area. Now, what about that? We have histamine. Of course, we know that histamine is going to cause the blood vessels to dilate. Blood pressure is going to drop. It's going to cause the bronchial tissue to contract, making it difficult to breathe. That's a histamine kind of problem. And or the eosinophils when they come, there's an enzyme that breaks down histamine to neutralize those effects. So the eosinophils are drawn by the chemotactic factor. The eosinophil chemotactic factor is there. And that will bring in these cells and will produce them and release histaminase, and things will start to go back to normal. The next one on the list, however, serotonin, is a neurotransmitter. And as a neurotransmitter, it's not going to be neutralized by factors coming from the eosinophil. So right away, there's going to be a difference. But secondly, the neurotransmitter is what gives the person who's having a reaction sort of a relaxed mood, half a glass of wine kind of thing. They're going to put the people around them at ease. That should tell the people around who are knowledgeable that that's a symptom. The fact that you think it's okay, that you'll swell up like a balloon, and it happens all the time, and you'll be fine, you'll be back in a little bit, that relaxed, cavalier attitude of what could be a fatal event is not logically correct. Right? You say, oh my goodness, I'm swelling up, I must go to the hospital, I could be dead in 15 minutes. No, they say, oh yeah, I'll be fine. Nobody will. So the serotonin gives that patient that disarming reaction. Or ESLP, eosinophil, chemotactic factor, of course, is coming from the mast cell, attracting the eosinophil. We'll skip down some of these. There's proteases that will impact mucosal secretions, particularly in the bronchial area, which are already contracted, so now we have contracted the bronchial tissue, and now we start clogging them up with mucus, which gives the person the difficulty of breathing, particularly here. Platelet activating factor can occur, and platelets are going to get sticky. When platelets get sticky, that means they're releasing their own set of mediators, and when a cell releases its mediators, it's called its degranulization. So we have the degranulization of platelets, just like we're seeing the degranulization of mast cell. We talked about the arachidonic acid pathway, and its leukotrienes, which are known as the slow reactive substrate prolaxis. These leukotrienes do the same sort of things as histamine. They just do it slower. It's like a 3-hour delay. And prostaglandins, they enable a whole variety of things. Platelet activation, contraction of pulmonary muscles, so vasodilation. It's amplifying what histamine does. In addition, there are a whole host of cytokines. I'm not going to go through those with you at this point. I'm going to get more in terms of which ones we can neutralize, which ones we can delay. Just recognize that in the event, and then type 1 hypersensitivity, we have cytokine release. So we have lots of things going on. Lots of compounds being released. So what we need to do, we need to use antihistamines. Okay? We're trying to save the patient's life. We're trying to get rid of all the components and all the reactions. We're just going to pick the major ones so that we can keep them alive. Antihistamines will reduce the effect of the histamine. We can start getting the blood pressure back where it needs to be. Start contracting the blood vessels. We start opening up the bronchial areas so they can breathe better. That's all good stuff. We're also going to give them, as part of this emergency room treatment, epinephrine or adrenaline to help stimulate the blood flow again. So we have two things that we're going to do in the emergency room: antihistamine and epinephrine. We have the EpiPens that can help do some of that actually. We can also do something else. Chromalin. Chromalin is not done as an emergency pump, but as a long-term prophylaxis. Chromalin blocks the uptake of calcium from mast cells. Let's see where that goes. Let's see how it comes into play. Here we have mast cell with the allergen and the two molecules of IgE, and we talked about the activation. And so once they get two on there, there's a conformational change that activates mast cell. If we have an anti-isotopic antibody, that is an antibody to the heavy chain conformation, IgE, that will cross-link them, and that will activate the mast cell. An anti-idiotype antibody, that will cross-link them, that will activate them. Cross-linking chemically will do it. An antibody to the receptor, like we saw in the grape disease, that will do it. Okay. And then, interestingly enough, an ionophore, which is really a gateway for increasing calcium, will do it. These are different experimental designs that give us a better sense of what's going on. So basically, when mast cells are coated with antibodies, IgE, and the uptake of calcium. Crumulin blocks the uptake of calcium. So you have the allergen, you have the IgE cleared mast cell, but you don't have the uptake of calcium, and you don't have the release of mediators. It stabilizes the mast cell. It blocks the release of mediators. I've seen it advertised in television that it cures allergic reaction. It doesn't cure the reaction. It just blocks the release of the mediators. You still have IgE, but you still have the sensitized mast cell, and so on. Theophylline and cortisone can be used for treatment, particularly for asthmatics, but they are, particularly the cortisone, that's heavy-duty stuff. Heavy-duty suppression, and it's not typically used because it's broader effects, Cushing syndrome and so on. Okay, let's take a look at this. This is, again, something that we see as the general pattern as well as the IgE, conformational change, that's going to trigger adding cytokine activity. We have a phospholization, we create reactions, and we convert ATP to cyclic AMP, which activates kinase, which in turn then triggers the overall movement of these granules towards the surface. We saw the big granules at the periphery before. These are the swollen granules we talked about, the mediators in it. Here's our step three, really, was the uptake of calcium. And the release of mediators is called demineralization. So we have allergen binds, the IgE, conformational change. Then we're going to be seeing the complement of calcium uptake, the activation of the kinase, and the movement of the granules. We also have the activation of the aromatic acid pathway that we talked about. So this is sort of the general overview. But remember, the antibody in the surface of the cell, the superimmunoglobulin family activity, is the same sort of thing. You can see adenocyclase being the second messenger for the Nobel Prize now, right? Something you got Nobel Prize, second messenger. So we have a common overall biological event here that we don't want to simply say this only occurs in mast cells. Now we see the same kind of thing. We have receptor sites, conformational change, activation of phospholipase. And most likely this is wrong. Don't worry about really what it's going to do. If we do a skin test to find out if you're allergic to something, what is this person allergic to? Rash, see? This is known as a real and flare reaction. It's not simply redness, but it's like a mosquito bite. It's a raised area. It's red there, and it's going to itch as well because we have histamine reduced. So this is a fluid inject histamine into the skin, it's the same kind of reaction. So this is the local release of histamine. And this is all versus the skin. Now, where you have the reactions in the body are called shock organs. Humans have shock organs in the following area. Skin, as you can see here, which is most dramatic when you see it on the face. So people's face swells up and their nose swells up and so on. Another shock organ would be the lungs. Another shock organ would be the GI tract. So these are areas that are loaded with mast cells that then become sensitized with IgE, and when the allergen comes along, they have a reaction there. That's why we often see a pulmonary effect. We might see a diarrheal effect. Now, if we're going to find out if you have an allergy, one way to do this is to find out, do you have more IgE than normal? You do this. You do this one. Let's move to the light here. You take any kind of inert substance here, you carry it, maybe a bead or a disc or something. And on it, we put an antibody to IgE. Anti-IgE. We then add the patient's serum, and now it will bind like that. And so we have picking up IgE on this, it would be an anti-IgE reagent, rogue anti-human IgE, and the uncle body. And then we have the patient's antibody binding that. We then add another uncle body, again, the same anti-IgE. This one's got a radioactive label to it. It should look like vertical pressure here. and that will bind. And then we count the label, and we know how much IgE is in the bloodstream of the patient. And this tells us that you have a history of allergies. You have higher than normal levels of IgE. But that's really not the specific question of life. Specific question of life, what are you allergic to? We know you're allergic. You told me that you have all these reactions. This is a follow-up study. We take the allergies that we think you're allergic to, the beta-lactam ring of penicillin, for example, and we put it on a solid compound. We then have the patient's sera and let it bind to it. Now, if they have IgG or IgM or IgE to this, it'll bind. So that's fine to the allergy. We then add the radioactive label, and it binds only to the IgE. On this one, it shows only IgE binding here, so we have only IgE here. This is now epitope-specific IgE in the bloodstream. An extremely small amount of IgE to begin with, and a very small subset of that is the particular epitope. This is a very sensitive test, and it's called the radioallosorbent test, RAST, R-A-S-T, the radioallosorbent test. It'll tell us how much IgE you have to a particular epitope. It will tell us whether you're allergic to the beta-lactam ring or our group that may be different between penicillin and amoxicillin. RAST, R-A-S-T. If we go to the, we have a history of allergies, so we can go to the allergist and become hyposensitized. That is, what we do is we inject you with a small amount of what you're allergic to. How many people come to the allergist? We inject you with a small amount of what you're allergic to. And we have you wait for about 20 minutes or so to see if you didn't screw up in dilution and get a massive reaction that shouldn't happen. But you should feel that it's a little bit like a half a glass of wine, and you get that release of serotonin, and you feel a little bit different, which I'll leave you drive home. And what's happened is that you triggered mast cells to release immediately. And they are destroyed in the process. The mast cell is destroyed to release the immediately. Now, since we gave you only a little bit of allergen, you'll have a small amount of IgE produced over the next few weeks, but not nearly as much as you lost with the first desensitization. So let's say you start with a certain area of tissue that had a million mast cells in it. And you go through step one, day one, and we go from a million down to 900,000. Then over the next few weeks, we add back a little bit to 910,000. So in that effect, you went from 900, from a million to 910,000 mast cells in certain tissue. And we don't do this once, we do this a whole series of times. We drop down to 800,000, 700,000, 500,000, 200,000, 150,000. So now we went from a million down to 150,000 mast cells in a certain tissue that sensitizes a particular allergy. This works if you're allergic to something that comes around every once in a while. Okay? So if you're allergic to hay fever, if you're allergic to bee stings, and you live in Michigan, you're only going to get some of the bees typically in a certain part of the year. Hay fever, certain part of the year. So we desensitize you against that in the months leading to that. And then by the time the season comes around, you're not going to have a reaction. Now, 2 weeks into the season, however, it will get worse because you're building up all those mast cells again. So we sensitize that. We're going to do this again every year. Desensitize the patient. We resensitize and desensitize the cell. So that lowers the level of hyposensitization. During this period of time, however, some patients, many patients, will develop an IgG to their allergen because we constantly expose them. They actually switch from going IgE to make an IgG. This is called a blocking antibody. The blocking antibody binds to the allergen in the bloodstream before it gets to the sensitized mast cell, and now that really prevents an allergic reaction. So after several years, maybe 4 or 5 years or more, they don't have a problem anymore at all. So it's the second thing you can have, development of a blocking antibody of an IgG class. And the other thing to think about is, to produce this antibody requires you to have a helper T cell. And some people will grow out of allergies because they stop producing IgE, which usually comes around in the 40s and 50s. They just stop producing the helper T cell for that particular epitope, and they don't produce that antibody anymore. They grow out of the allergy. There's also a subset that grow into the allergy because they've lost the suppressor cell. So that all along the suppressor cell don't do that, and now at age 45 they grow into halogens. All men are their aging of their immune system. What cell do they lose for helper and suppressor? If it's a late onset, usually in about 10 years they'll go back out of it again. We'll lose that to get help. I'll review that when we talk next time.